Joining us on the line from NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center is Dr. Eric Smith, who is the James Webb Space Telescope Program Director. Thanks for joining us this morning, Eric.
My pleasure.
Now, we have a few things we'd like to ask you about the program, if that's okay.
All right, go for it.
Firstly, why is the space telescope called James Webb?
James Webb was NASA's second administrator after the agency was founded in the late 1950s. And he is responsible for designing the Apollo program. That was, of course, a very successful program, took us to the moon. But we've named a science experiment after him because he argued very effectively at that time with then President Kennedy, who wanted NASA to just be all about beating the Soviets to the moon. And Webb argued that in order to achieve that goal, you needed to have the best scientists and engineers. And to attract them, you need to let them do their science. And so there's science at the agency because James Webb recognized its importance.
So if it wasn't for him, they wouldn't be any of it.
Probably no science at NASA. That's certainly arguably true.
Well, I mean, looking at the space telescope, and I really wish I had a chance to get down there because I'm just north of you. I'm just outside of Harrisburg.
Oh, okay. I grew up in Camp Hill.
Oh my. I'm in Shireman's Town.
Oh, okay.
We're neighbors.
Yeah.
So, Mark, for your own reference, Shireman's Town actually shares Camp Hill's zip code.
Oh, okay.
We're yeah. We're basically right next to each other. But the one thing with the James Webb is that I know that a lot of people who aren't following it very closely are going to be saying, oh, well, this is a Hubble replacement. That's not really true, is it?
That's right. We like to call it the scientific successor to the Hubble Space Telescope. So Hubble has revealed many amazing things about the universe, but it has also shown where its limits are. There are things it just cannot do because it's a visible, optimized for visible light, and its mirror is a certain size. To go beyond what Hubble can see, we knew we needed a bigger telescope. So our mirror area is 7 times larger than Hubble's. And because we knew that some of the science was going to be in the infrared part of the spectrum, the heat part of the spectrum, not so much visible light, we made a much larger infrared optimized. So you can think of it as continuing the legacy of Hubble science, but it's also very complementary. It doesn't duplicate what Hubble does.
Right, because doesn't Hubble also operate in the ultraviolet range?
That's correct. Hubble can see down to, you know, blueward of where humans can see. And Hubble sees a little bit into the infrared as well. But Webb is optimized. It sees a little bit into the visible, the very reddest part of the spectrum that our eyes can see, and then much farther out into the infrared.
So would James Webb and Hubble be able to simultaneously examine the same objects but across a broad spectrum of frequencies?
That's what a lot of folks are planning on right now. Hubble has continued its amazing success story, and now folks think both will be operating at the same time. And I know there are already people thinking, wow, it'd be amazing to get images of the same thing at the same time. Of course, most things in space don't change that rapidly, so you can observe it with one and then come back and observe it with the other a little bit later.
Now, the space telescope is due to launch from Kourou in French Guiana on an Ariane 5 next year. Now, as you know, they've currently got all their launches on hold at the moment due to the protests going on there. Do you think that with possible backlog of launches, it might affect the launch of the telescope?
That clearly depends on how long the unrest goes on down there. If it goes on long enough, then it would start backing up. The launch queue would back up. Some of the launches can go at any time. Others require certain launch windows. So that would be the job of Arianespace, and in our case, the European Space Agency, who that's our interface to Arianespace. We would have to work out how that would affect our launch window.
One of the things that the Hubble was designed to do was be maintained by astronauts, you know, during its life cycle. Obviously, we don't have a shuttle program anymore. We don't have any way to get anyone to the James Webb Space Telescope if something goes wrong. So what kind of things did you end up doing for this to make sure that everything is perfect because you have no backup.
Well, interestingly, Hubble really is the only satellite that was designed to be serviced and was, in fact, serviced. So we're following the procedures that are normal in the aerospace industry. In our case, we're using what we call a sort of a Pathfinder philosophy. So you build models of what the flight unit will look like, and you test those models and you practice with those, and then you build a next generation model that's a little closer to the flight unit. And so this Pathfinder approach allows us to test out hardware along the way to the flight build. And then once you have the flight build, it has to go through a very extensive test program itself. And that's sort of where we are right now in the program. It's a very challenging phase. And we also do things like where there are electric motors, we have two ways to address the motor. In some cases, we have redundant motors. So where you can build in redundancy, you do it. There are some things, obviously, we only have one secondary mirror on the telescope, so you can't make that redundant. But the philosophy is use the Pathfinder approach, build in redundancy where you can, and test, test, test.
You never get too much testing done.
Yeah, eventually you have to take it away from the engineers because they would just test it forever.
After launch, how long will it take the telescope to reach its orbit? And once there, how long before we start getting results back?
So it takes us about a month to get out to the second Lagrange point, L2. And that's about 1,000,000 miles from Earth, 4 times farther than the orbit of the moon. We get there in a month. But because we're this infrared observatory, we need to cool down. You want the telescope to be very cold so you don't see your own heat from the telescope. And that process of cooling down and then calibrating the telescope takes another 5 months. So you can expect to see the first science about 6 months after what we call the commissioning phase. This is where we're checking out the instruments, we're calibrating them so that they're ready for the science community.
So why is James Webb having to travel a lot further than Hubble for its science?
This, again, relates back to the infrared optimization of the telescope. Because we're looking for very faint signals of heat from the universe, we want to be far from any large sources of heat ourselves. And the Earth is a big source of infrared radiation. So a lot of satellites only orbit a few hundred miles above the Earth. We want to be very far from the Earth. And that means if we go to this L2 point, it's a semi-stable point in the gravity field of the Earth and the Sun, so we don't need to use a lot of fuel to keep us in an orbit around that. And then we follow the Earth around the Sun. And because we're out at this L2 point, it allows us also to keep the Earth, the Sun, and the Moon sort of in the same direction in the sky. So we only need a sun shield, like a parasol, rather than a tube, to protect us from that light.
Okay, so you mentioned that it does have a fuel reserve on board, but is it going to get most of its energy from solar panels? And based on that, given the absolute optimal situation, how long can the James Webb Space Telescope be operable out there?
Well, you're right in that we get all our electrical power from solar panels. And we're not a very power-hungry mission, so there's plenty of electrical power for us to do the science for a long, long time. Our life-limiting factor is the fuel that we use for station keeping, and we are carrying about 10 years worth of fuel. Now, we could even imagine that being stretched a little bit longer than 10 years by such factors as if we get a very precise launch trajectory from the Ariane 5 rocket, then we don't have to use any fuel to sort of correct ourselves going into orbit. So we might save a little fuel there. And I suspect as the Space Telescope Science Institute learns how to operate the telescope, they may even think of ways to conserve fuel. So we'll take 10 years of fuel, and hopefully we can squeeze another couple of years out of it as well.
And that doesn't mean that it won't be operable after that. What would be the issues with that running out of fuel? It might seem obvious, but at the same time, not so much.
We actually point the telescope not using fuel. We don't use these fuel jets to move us around and point. We use the gyroscope effect. So we have six spinning wheels on the telescope. And by changing the rates of spin, that's how we point ourselves at different places in the sky. But after time, one or more of these gyroscopes get spun up to such a high degree that you would need to use fuel to de-spin it, we say. Eventually, if you don't have any fuel, you can't de-spin it, and then you're less able to control where it looks. That doesn't mean you can't get data back from it, but now you're just sort of looking at random places in the sky.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the technology behind the actual way that it actually folds into the Ariane 5 rocket and then what happens after it's deployed?
Yeah, this is a very exciting, almost in the Chinese proverb sense of that feature of the telescope. Because our mirror is bigger than the diameter of any rocket fairing, we knew we had to somehow fold it up. And we actually did, you know, little origami experiments early on to try to decide what's the best way to cut up a mirror and then have it deploy or fold out. And so we looked at designs that had things that almost looked like flower petals, where some were folded down and some were folded up, and then they either, you know, folded back down or folded up to form a mirror. The current design we have is a little bit like a drop leaf table, where the sides pop up. There were even designs that had a hexagonal segment, but they were stacked up almost like Pringles potato chips, and they would spin out and drop down to form a big mirror that way. So those were studies that were done in the late 1990s, and it was a very interesting time to see which of the deployment schemes would win out. In the end, we came up with probably what's the simplest one. And usually the simplest thing is the easiest to manufacture then, too.
Will the James Webb have a part to play in the researching of the planets that orbit in the TRAPPIST-1 star?
Oh, most certainly. So this is a very recent and exciting discovery of these seven planets, some of which lie within what we call the habitable zone, that they're close enough to the star that if there is liquid water, if there is water, it would be in the liquid form. And it's close enough that it would be a very prime target for Webb. So the only question is, will somebody propose that in the first cycle of observations, or will they wait till the second? But people are definitely going to be looking at that, and probably even other nearby exoplanets.
Okay. Well, that also brings in another question. How do you schedule time? People don't just say, oh, hey, let's just make this request to have them look at this thing. That all needs to be scheduled, you know, and people get their own little slice of when they can use the James Webb Space Telescope. So how do you go about doing that? How do you go about prioritizing what tasks it should do first, and putting some others on the back burner?
Good question. So at the Space Telescope Science Institute, which is just off the Johns Hopkins campus in Baltimore, they run a competition. Every year they put out a so-called call for proposals, and people send in their ideas, and then they convene several hundred scientists come in and review all these proposals. And it's through that mechanism that people decide, wow, this is really exciting. I think we should do this. You know, this one's not such an interesting idea, or this one's good, but it needs some improvement. And so through this peer review process, you assemble a big list of these are the science programs we'd like to do. Then you give that to the software that controls the telescope, and that optimizes the schedule for the telescope throughout that year. And it's there that you begin to try to figure out, how can I minimize my use of fuel by scheduling these things? And unlike Hubble, we are an event-driven telescope. So we'll give the telescope a week or so many days worth of things to do and tell it, you know, go look at these objects. If it encounters a fault or it finishes early, it'll just go on to the next thing. Hubble, because it's a much older telescope and operating system, it was time tagged. So Hubble was told every second what it should be doing. And if it ran into a problem, it would just have to wait until the next scheduled event came along before it could do anything. Whereas Webb, if it's done or it encounters a problem, it's just going to go on to the next thing in its schedule, thereby increasing its efficiency.
What other kind of tests are you going to be doing for it, besides obviously launch preparation, just to make sure that it's all ready, because it's almost a year and a half?
You know, we've had a lot of challenges putting this together, inventing the technologies, manufacturing them, and now It's basically integrated into two big parts. Here at Goddard, they have the actual telescope itself and the science instruments, the cameras and spectrographs. And then out at Northrop Grumman, they have the spacecraft bus, the thing that holds the fuel tanks and batteries, and also the sun shield. So eventually those two things will come together later in 2017. But each component goes through some pretty severe tests. So they put it on shaker tables that shake it with the same vibration frequencies that it will see on the Ariane 5 rocket. They blast it with the sound of a launch, which at 140 decibels is 30 decibels wow. louder than a typical rock concert. They will put it into thermal vacuum chambers where they take the hardware down to temperatures about 40 degrees above absolute zero. They will, of course, measure all the optics to make sure they still reflect light down into the instruments the way they're supposed to. And then they will do deployment testing. They'll practice all these pieces that need to fold out and fold up. They'll do tests for those, and then they'll fold it all up and they'll deploy it again. And usually in these tests, I mean, you find problems. That's why you test it in the first place, because you want to make sure it will eventually work in space. So you're right in that it seems pretty close, but there's a lot of hard work that goes on between now and then to verify that the stuff we've built actually will work the way we want it to.
Finally, how can our listeners find out more about the mission?
You can send them to jwst.nasa.gov. And at that website, they'll find not only text and images about the hardware, but there are links to YouTube videos showing how different pieces have been manufactured or tested. There's a Flickr link to hundreds or probably even thousands of images of the hardware, little stories about some of the people involved. It's a pretty well-developed website.
I know you're a very busy man, but thanks again for taking the time out to speak with us this morning, Eric.
Oh, my pleasure.
It's been an absolute privilege to chat with someone who's involved in such an important mission.
And any way we can help spread the message is great, and look forward to you guys helping us get that message out.
And seeing as how I live so close, maybe next time when we chat, it can actually be person to person.
Now I live down in Maryland, but if I'm up in Camp Hill, we could probably do that.
I'd have no problem coming down there. Less than 2 hours. Come on.
Yeah, that's true. It's about an hour and a half from there.
I suppose we better let you get back to it. And we hope to work with you guys in the future.
Okay. Well, I'm sure folks at NASA love talking about their work. So, you know, just get in touch and I'm sure they'll be happy to do so.
Thanks again.
Yep. Thank you.
Okay. You're welcome. Bye-bye.